I talked to him about career print in printing. And that was my motivation for going into it.
So you, did you, what role did the Journal and Guide play, other than the fact, I mean, obviously as a, I mean, it was one way for you to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Did it begin to shape your outlook on life? What would you read it as you were delivering that stuff?
Yeah, well, I don't see, I suppose that it was almost like a substitute kind of thing, you know, something trying to search for a career. I guess the other thing that actually worked out with me, that was doing something with your hands and all. And I seemed to enjoy doing things in that manner. And I hate to put it like this, but I guess it was getting away from going to be a doctor. I just didn't, that didn't appeal to me. And and the architect part was, would have probably been a good occupation, but I guess print was like a compromise.
What did your father have to say about it? What was
he didn't, he sort of, as he did in the case of my brothers, he sort of left it up to me. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I think my aunt, who was the person that financed my education until I decided I would work and take care of myself. After about 2 years, I told her that she could concentrate on my brother, that I would printing. I was doing actual mechanical end, I was doing the press work and all. We had some opportunities to do a little writing for the newspaper and also being able to put it together in a good form and pattern and make it attractive. And I did write a little column and also we sold some advertisements, things like that. So it was something in addition to the actual mechanical end. Mm-hmm. It gave you some leeway to learn something about newspaper publishing and this kind of thing. So I found it very interesting.
And you were actually doing a column.
Yeah, I did a column, but just a small column. It wasn't much. I was writing for that, just a small column for the newspaper.
And what was the column about?
It was just some personal experiences and this type of thing. It was I didn't consider myself a experienced writer or anything like that, but maybe 4 or 5 inches is some brief experience or something I had. And in fact, I remember one column that I wrote about a visit that I made to homecoming at Hampton, something like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. White, what would you say that the philosophy of the Tribune was during those years?
It was the editorials and things was very good in terms of attacking discrimination and this type of thing. And it was trying to cover the type of news that showed the black community in a good light, and also really a historical type of thing. And the editor, the paper publisher, H.I. Fontelio Nantone, was a very well-trained person who knew how to write and express himself and this kind of thing. Attacking the problems that faced the black community and also encouraging those in the community to do their best to make it. Yeah.
And when did you meet your other eventual partner at the service?
Not the one that sent for me, the one that, you talking about, oh, Walter Swan. He came over to Raleigh, and I can't really now think of what his circumstances was, but he used to work for the Carolina Times, the newspaper in Durham. And he came over to Raleigh, I guess, to get a job. And we worked together for a while there. So that's the three of us that were, my brother was a fourth partner, was still in school then. He didn't finish until 1940. And by that time, we were in Durham.
I see. But when you were still in Raleigh, did you plan initially or did you have aspirations at this time to eventually open a printing shop, or was it something that you just began talking about?
Well, it was a very interesting thing. The owner of the Carolina Tribune spoke about retiring. And that didn't seem to appeal to me, that this man was getting ready to retire. And I didn't think about, as I look back on it, I didn't think about that would be an opportunity to own the newspaper or something like that. But I just thought about working and taking care of this man in his retirement. Now, that's just a young guy's thoughts running through your mind that didn't appeal to me. So I told him that I was going to leave. And when I told him that I was going to leave, he talked to Reed, the fellow who sent for me, and was telling him what a bad fellow I was and this kind of thing. And so Reed said, well, you know, I know him, and he doesn't seem to be that kind of fellow. So he told him he was leaving, too. Now, this fellow that came over there from Durham knew about the Service Printing Company. And he told us about the opportunity that we had to manage this company. Real company. about the fact that he may have been saying that he was going to sell us the newspaper. Uh-huh. Is that?
Oh.
Yeah. But that didn't been a conversation, so that wasn't a decision to be made.
That he might sell you the newspaper?
No, he didn't. Oh. That come. I made a little talk at his funeral, and I did. I don't know whether I expressed that or not. I may have, but I expressed, you know, the fact that something I was complimentary to him and all, and I guess the thought came to me. Was this guy saying that he was retiring and going to give us the opportunity to own the paper or not? But that didn't ever come up in the discussion. But I wonder what would have been my career or what it would have been like if I had looked at it from that point of view. But that was just one of those things. And it also gives me the thought that you always think that great big things are things that influence your life sometime, and sometimes the very small things that make the difference between you living in one town or another, or getting one trade or something else like that. And that was the case of at that time, and that's just the way I thought, and that was the result that I was leaving. And so everything worked out all right, I think.
Uh-huh. So coming, when you came to Durham to manage and then eventually to own the service printing company, what was black business like? Was service printing company was that in the Haytai?
In the Haytai area, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And were there other black entrepreneurs that you could work with? Did you have an organization or?
Oh yeah. outstanding city for black businesses. And it has really, for its size, it's one of the leading cities in the country for African American entrepreneurs. And that was readily visible when we came to Durham. It was altogether different from Raleigh, I think. And in fact, the Mechanics and Farmers Bank, which was based in Durham, had a branch in Raleigh and still has a branch. And of course, they had a newspaper. Had a savings and loan association, had a fire insurance company, Bankers Fire Insurance Company, and the whole atmosphere of business was different. And to some extent, it's still like that. The accomplishments and of African American businesses is just outstanding, I think. And I think probably it grew out of the fraternal organizations that were based in this city. And the idea of taking care of each other really is outstanding. And so when we came at a time that in 1939, it was very visible, and it proved to be a good choice on our for us to make. And we had what we considered a very successful career in operating in Durham.
And you mentioned the fraternal organizations. Did you become involved at this time in fraternal organizations?
Well, I joined the Masons at one time, and what actually happened, I became a scoutmaster in 1942, and they met on the same night as my scout group. I set my scout meeting on Mondays because in my trade, our business, you have another day to take care of anything that you had to plan. But if you normally I would have met on Friday nights, that's better for the boys. But then I would find myself canceling the meeting or postponing or having another day and this kind of thing. So I sacrificed the membership in the Masons to work with the Boy Scouts, which I don't regret. I'm glad I did, because I think I probably had an opportunity to make a contribution that I would not have to make if I did not assume that position. And I was willing always to sort of give something back based on what the benefits that had been given me as a youth.
And, Mr. White, you mentioned the fraternal organizations. What kind of a difference did they make in terms of
African American? See, as a person coming in and observing, if you probably get a picture of Fayetteville Street as it stood before the freeway came through, you see these multi-story buildings and all on Fayetteville Street. There were about four of them that were built by lodges and groups. And this effort, and I think out of that, the North Carolina Future Life Insurance Company was organized in almost 100 years ago, 1898. And the bank was organized in 1910, and a few years they organized. So the bitch spent the most bitch to protect the good head of the woman. I think the idea of doing things to take care of each other sort of took hold here, and you got some remarkable achievements. You see the North Carolina Mutual building downtown, and at one time, I suppose it might be still so true that it was the largest business in the world that we had. That was right here in Durham, a relatively small community. And it's a tremendous demonstration of what can be done and what was done in this city to show the possibilities of working together and working for the benefit of each other.
Mr. White, were you, I think that Mr. Bryant mentioned that both of you are active in a number of different organizations,
right.
Community organizations. What were some of those organizations, and what did you do?
Well, we work, first of all, we were members of the same church, and we were working together, and we were members of the Durham Business and Professional Chain, and the Durham Business and Professional Chain was organized by J.J. Henderson, who also was a Hampton graduate. And those organizations not only work for the benefit of people all running businesses, but it worked in the general overall community. Mm-hmm. And the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People. So that's when some of the instances where we work it together.
Uh-huh. Now the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, I'm trying to remember what Mr. Bryant told me about that. What that group had different committees?
Yeah, subcommittees. Yeah.
The subcommittees. And what particular subcommittees did you work on?
I worked on the economic subcommittee, the economic development, I think they were called. But at the time I was working, I'm not sure the exact name on it. But anyway, I worked on that committee. I also, Floyd McKissick, I sought his help and assistance to work with me, and we were co-chairs of the committee. And now all the committees have co-chairs. And so it was in that committee gives you an opportunity in your working in your own business, and also give you an opportunity to serve your community with whatever talents you might present to assist in uplifting of the community.
Mm-hmm. And you began working with the Durham Committee in the 40s, or?
Yes, shortly after I came here. Oh. Yeah, we came in 39. Mm-hmm. And the Durham Durham Business Professional Chain was organized in 1938. Now, the Durham Committee was organized before that, so but shortly after I came here, I started working with the committee.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. White, what were some of the, with all the different groups and committees, did the groups have different visions of what the Black community should be like in Durham? Were there?
I think they were fairly well unified on what visions they had for the community. But everything changes somewhat from time to time. You have problems, and you solve problems, then you move to other problems, and just keep working. And of course, one of the key problems was voting and electing, trying to get African-American representatives, people in office to, in a democracy, if you're going to participate, you need to get out and vote and run for office and this kind of thing. So it's a matter of doing what any citizen should do, is to contribute with your talents and other means to make your city better and make it better for you as citizens in the community.
Mr. White, how did you and the committee go about approaching voting issues in the 30s?
Well, I guess your first task was to be able to vote. You know, that's an effort. You know, there are all kinds of means and ways of denying the vote to black citizens. There's a grandfather clause. There was you were not a whole citizen. And then I remember going to the poll to vote, and there was a registrar reading out of a book, and I think if they didn't have that book, they might not be able to tell me the answers to the questions that they asked of me. That thing of thoughts occurred to me. And you have to, but instead of making it welcoming you to come in to fulfill your citizenship duties, there was a method to try to keep you from voting. And that thought sure came to my mind when I was looking at that, you know. Suppose they didn't have that book, could they answer that question? But anyway, it was a fight to vote.
And when did you first try to vote?
Shortly after I came to there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was there already an organized effort within the black community?
Oh yeah. But you see, that was interesting. Another thing was interesting that we didn't have precincts in your community. We went downtown to the courthouse to register. Then later on, they had different precincts around, you know.
And were all the registrars in those days white?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
What were some of the things that they would do to obstruct you from exercising your voting rights?
Well, as I say, you know, that when you registered, they would ask you questions about the Constitution and this kind of thing. Of course, if you had reasonable knowledge about things, you couldn't deny you that. But there was a strong effort, you know, just to try to prevent you from voting. So the Durham Committee, you know, have organized the community and organized people and encouraged them to register to vote.
And how would the committee go about doing that?
They would do that in their meetings. They would do that in public meetings, get out the vote campaigns. When they had the precinct, they would organize people into going into the door-to-door basis. And then later on, they got registrars that they registered people to vote. So it was a kind of a growing type of thing. Then they had the, I remember when they had the first, elected the first person to the city council, R.N. Harris. And it's been growing ever since.
Were churches involved in this campaign?
I think the committee used the churches, and then they used also, they had announcements made in the churches to call attention to registration and voting. Then they'd have rallies, mass rallies, where they had speakers to speak to and try to encourage people to vote.
And when did that start, the rally?
Oh, that's been going for some time. It started before I came here. I don't know exactly precise time, but after the Civil War, it seemed that they had a period of participation by the freedmen, and it seemed like along near the turn of the century, they had a reversal. So Mr. Scarborough, the undertaker here, we used to have what we call the 1 o'clock luncheon club. He used to talk about that period where they had postmasters, black postmasters, and I guess that's a part of the thing that you all are looking at, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
That he talked about how he made some interesting statements. I don't personally have that much knowledge about it, of course, but I imagine that's an interesting period to look at. And then they had a reversal of things with the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. And they had segregation and all, and that, in other words, you had to open it up and then a shut down. And for me, born in 1914, I had a whole period of where things were closed off. Just like you mentioned earlier about the buses and streetcars and things. And we may not still have caught up to the fullest extent when you hear people talk and you hear politicians talk. And I think that segregation gave people a misconception about what should be happening and what is happening, and attitudes of not just segregated but an inferior type situation. And I mean, you have, say, people like George Washington Carver, Frederick Douglass, and Booker T. Washington, people who did great things, and people still wondering about whether or not you are capable. And then they are. This guy Rutgers up there, what is it, president? I mean, how could he do that in 1995? But, anyway, that's the kind of a thing that can come out of discrimination and misconception and wrong ideas.
Well, Mr. White, it's interesting that you mentioned that earlier period, because it seems to be connected to this current. Well, one of the things that seems to connect it is the church, because I mean, this church has been here since those early years, since 1866.
Right.
What a rich history this church must have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this church, for example, they had a library in this church that later became the the Stanford L. Warren Library. We had a minister that featured recreation, Reverend Dr. Miles Marks Fisher. He had a community softball league, and I understand that that probably may have been the first public recreation in town. The library, they had a nursery school, and had all kinds of things coming out of the church.
And was White Rock the church that you joined when you first came to Durham?
Yes, I joined White Rock. And I've been a member of it ever since.
And then how did you come to White Rock? Did you just, was it an accident or?
Well, I think I got in my business, the printing business, I got to know the pastor of this church, Dr. Miles Mark Fisher. And I joined the church